You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
Welcome to Heritage Voices, episode 23.
I'm Jessica Uquinto, and I'll be your host today. And today we are talking about the Salish Kootenai College's Tribal Historic Preservation Program. Before we begin, I'd like to honor and acknowledge the Nooch, or Ute peoples, on whose treaty lands I'm recording today, as well as the other tribes with ancestral and cultural connections to this land, including the fact that this land is part of the ancestral Puebloan homeland and the Dene Ta. On today's episode, we have Aaron Bryan. Aaron Bryan is a member of the Absaloga Nation, a Big Lodge clan, and child of the Whistling Water and Big Lodge clan. He is a member of the Nighthawk Dance Society. He was born in Sheridan, Wyoming, and raised on the Crow Reservation Center Lodge, Reno District. Bryan studied at Salish Kootenai College and the University of Montana as an undergraduate, and earned a master's degree from the University of Montana's Department of Anthropology. He currently serves as Native American Studies and Tribal Historic Preservation faculty at Salish Kootenai College. His early contributions to cultural heritage emphasize indigenous approaches to archaeological documentation and interpreting, drawing attention to the significance of collaborating with elders to interpret and manage resources in the Pryor Mountains of Montana. His work represents the future of indigenous cultural heritage management and is helping teach the next generation of archaeologists the importance of incorporating tribal perspectives into resource management. He was selected to give a TEDx presentation and has been invited to serve as a commencement speaker because of his impact on education on the Confederated Salish Kootenai Reservation, and was chosen to serve as a cultural consultant for National Geographic. He lives with his family in Arley, Montana. So welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Before we get started, let's learn a little bit more about you and how you got into this field.
Well, yeah, I can give you the long version, or I can give you the real quick, I took the cultural anthropology class and fell in love with it kind of version. The long version is far more interesting.
Let's do it.
Yeah. Well, actually, all of this started, I mean, growing up in Crow, I had a fairly strong connection with culture and identity. So I was always aware, for the most part, that being a Crow Indian, you know, is different than everybody else. It's kind of that idea, you know. In the fifth grade, my grandmother was actually my teacher. And we were doing a project on genealogy, you know, like pick somebody in your family to talk about, to speak about. And she picked the person for me. She picked my great-grandfather, Max Big Man. So I did this whole long project on Max Big Man. For a fifth grader, it seemed long, but it really wasn't that long, you know. But really, that's where the interest in identity, culture, in the history of the Crow people started for me, was getting to know who Max Big Man was and his role as an early Crow historian, and his kind of approach to understanding Crow identity and documenting Crow history. So it really started there. And then I kind of continued on to like pay attention to older people in my community. My mom had a little business called the Lighthouse Bakery, where men would come and pay a certain amount of money a month, and they could drink coffee at the house and eat donuts and pastries and stuff. So I got to hear quite a bit about Crow history and Crow politics and just the ideas of the Absaloga, right, through these older guys. And then later I took a Crow culture class from a lady named Loretta Three Irons, who I owe a lot to. She's really the one that made it seem real that I could be Indian, study Indian people, and feed my family. She just made it seem obtainable. So that, and I was about 16 years old then. So that led me to wanting to pursue a degree in Native American studies, because that was just seemed where I wanted to go with it. But I didn't know what an NAS degree was. I did get my bachelor's in NAS. And then I took a cultural anthropology class from Dr. Jeff Benjamin, who is the founder of the preservation program at SKC. So, and then that's when I realized, like, this is what I want to do. This this could give me the tools to study my own people. And it just kind of went from there, and then I got into graduate school, and it snowballed, and I'm here where I am now.
Okay. So could you talk a little bit more about the two programs that you were in for school?
Yeah. The Native American Studies mm-hmm. program and the anthropology program.
Yeah. And as well, like the tribal college and then the University of Montana.
Oh yeah. They were pretty different. I got my associate's degree from Salish Kootenai College. And then I transferred to the university. Salish SKC at the time seemed to be really driven by the tangible part of culture, I guess, like basket weaving and hide tanning and, you know, things like that, things you could kind of grab a hold of. So when I was getting my AA there, culture seemed very tangible to me. You know, it seemed very like, especially the study of it.
Right.
When I got to the university, it seemed very political, like it was driven by law and policy, like federal Indian policy and federal Indian law and concepts of sovereignty and things like that, which to me were cool and they were needed. But I've always been fascinated with like identity, right? And heritage and what that really means. So I enjoyed both programs equally, but I would say that I gained a lot out of the SKC program early on. Because it made me really kind of understand how ingenious my people are, you know? So, and you gain an appreciation for them.
Can you give an example?
Oh, just the process of tanning a hide, right? Like just going through mm-hmm. that process of treating it and working the hide and getting the hide soft and making it work. And I there was an old lady here that kind of a local celebrity named Ushani Kenmill. She was in her 90s, you know, when she passed away, but she taught the class. And so I learned from this really old lady how to do it. And I had seen people do it before in Crow. I had a neighbor that I watched do it one time, but no one ever sat me down and said, this is how you do it, you know? And so just seeing all the work and the effort and the nuances that go into something like that made me really appreciate how Indian people think, you know, and how detailed they are and how methodical they are, that nothing's rushed and nothing's pushed through and just for the sake of doing it, you know. In the Crow language, we call it akbayicha, and that means like the one who keeps things nice or makes it look good, you know, and that's like a quality to have, you know, as a person. So when I watched this old lady do that, I'd seen it firsthand, you know, and so for me, that meant more to me than a lot of the, you know, the Marshall Trilogy classes and the sovereignty classes and stuff. Cause I seen like, man, these are people we're saving, you know, like I'm one of these people, you know, and it really gave me value. Cause growing up on a reservation, especially during my time in the 90s, there wasn't a lot of value in being Indian, and you were taught opposite, you know, like you know, don't speak with an accent, cut your hair. And these were things Indian people were telling us, you know? So for me to see that and go to an environment where not only was it accepted to be Indian, it was like, it was encouraged, like take these classes, and SKC makes an effort to make them required. A lot of them, you know, our program requires a certain amount of those classes. I feel like that separates us from a lot of other academic programs is because we really push that idea, that part of our culture of Indian people, you know, like that there's a lot of work and there's a lot of effort and there's a lot of intricate thinking involved in how we do things. And that should translate in resource management. It should translate in scholarly works and things like that. So, and I just didn't get that from the university, you know?
I mean,
because that's not their job, you know, that their job isn't to restore identity. So,
yeah, I have two thoughts, I guess, coming off of that. First, I like the way that you put that about making sure that when you're doing things that you're doing it the right way in a well thought out way. And I think that a lot of times that can cause some conflict with things like tribal consultation, where the tribe takes it seriously on a different level than the other parties involved, or not seriously on a different level, but they're just thinking about it, I think, a lot of times more long term and more like really wanting to have the setup right as much as like the outcome, you know, whereas I feel like a lot of times with the federal agencies, it can be very like deliverable focused. So it's like, you know, the tribe might want to work on like not just a PA, but what does this PA mean for how we work together and like all of this background. And I think that's an area that can cause like some misunderstandings. And so I just really liked the way you put that about the process of doing something and doing it right and thinking it through. And second of all, so you basically, what you were talking about, you were at the Salish Kootenai College and having them have more of a material culture focus. And then you go to the university and it's more of a political outside focus looking in. What do you think, you know, coming from those two programs, what did you take and how did you, like, what way do you look at it now?
I think both programs have shifted towards the middle to kind of defend them both. The university has added some courses that are like more like oral and written traditions type stuff and native games type classes. And then SKC's always had kind of this flagship type class called the History of Indians in the U.S., just NAS 101. And it's taught differently than anywhere that I know people teach Indian history. And I actually teach it now. I teach one of the sections of it. Other than that, they teach federal Indian law, federal Indian policy. But if other than course title, I mean, they're going to be real similar. It's more like method, right? How do you teach it and what's the content you're using and in the angle of the content, you know? And I feel like at SKC, the angle in which we teach our content is driven by Indigenous perspective, which is different. So when we teach federal Indian law and policy, we don't just simply go over law and policy. We talk about how law and policy affects tribal society, especially at that time, which I don't think at the university, we didn't get into that a lot. They would a little bit. And that's just kind of the nature of a university, right? It's just, and I'm not trying to disrespect any university, but their efforts are towards something else, where tribal colleges efforts are driven by a different idea, you know, especially SKC. The tribal college model used to be the stepping stone for the university, but now that SKC has over a dozen bachelor's programs and it's more now we can do it the way we want to do it, you know, and the way we feel benefits Indian country. So
yeah, so you said that you teach it in a way that nobody else quite does. Can you elaborate on that a little?
Well, I mean, I don't know. I don't know. I just know from the courses I've taken, we have real world examples for one, you know, this isn't theoretical. This isn't like when we teach history, we're talking about our grandparents and our parents and it's very real to a lot of people that take our courses. When we talk about the Allotment Act, we're living on the Allotment Act. We're not talking about something that's far away, you know. So we say where so-and-so lives, that was part of this allotment. And these are people my students know, you know, and some of them are, that's their great grandparent or their grandparent. And so it takes on a whole different kind of identity, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
And so when we teach it, in a way, it's easier to teach it for us because we have that. We can see, when we talk about the Bureau of Indian Affairs, we don't talk about it in a, like it's Mars, you know, like it's over there. It's here. It's on us. You know what I mean? And so we know what the BIA is. So when we talk about sovereignty, we can talk about that in a very real sense, that what is it and how does it work and all that stuff. So. Because it's here, it's very much a part of the everyday in Indian country here. And so when we're teaching it, we're teaching at a tribal college to tribal students on an Indian reservation in a state that has 7 Indian reservations and over a dozen tribes. So it's definitely very much we're in the forest. You know what I mean? So when we teach it, we're teaching it from in the forest.
So what would you, for those of us who are not necessarily in the forest, or, you know, like myself, I live right next to the forest, I guess you could say,
are we going to keep going with the forest thing?
Yeah, I guess so. but since the Ute Mountain Reservation is about, you know, 10, 15 minutes away. So what kind of lessons for those of us that are outside the forest would you really want to hit home with these kinds of classes that you're talking about?
Well, I mean, what I always say first is, if you can go there and learn it, you know, go to Indian country and go to these places, you know, ultimately that's the best way, right? If you can't, I mean,
right.
Everyone's different, and the way you learn is different from the way I learn and the way other people learn. So I don't think it's up to me to decide how people can learn. But the first step is to make that step, is to go, is to try, at least try to get closer and try to get, and I guess that closeness can be different. It doesn't necessarily have to be there, but doing stuff like this, like what you're doing right now, mm-hmm. and making it available for people, you know. And obviously I'm not the spokesman for all of Indian country, and I don't claim to be, but I think for a discussion like this and what your program does in terms of archaeology and heritage management and all this stuff, just talking to everyday Indian people that live on the reservation or grew up there, whether they're not involved in the discipline, still benefits the discipline, because there's this disconnect that we have as archaeologists and resource managers with people. It's really weird. It blows my mind that people who specialize in studying people know nothing about humans. You know?
Right, right.
So just getting people who are like, what does this mean to you? What does that mean to you? Just getting like I think it'd be really cool to get a journalist, like an Indian journalist who works in Indian country on your podcast.
You know, that would be interesting.
And ask mm-hmm. them questions, not questions about journalism, but ask them questions about what we would talk about. Because that's going to give us a sense of what the public actually knows we do.
Right.
Because do they know? You know, I mean, the truth is like we live in this little like nerd vacuum, and I love it. I love it, you know.
Yes.
But sometimes we got to get out of that. So I guess yes. I'm kind of going off. But your podcast, I think, is a starting point. And nowadays, we live in an era with technology that there's really no excuse. You know, there's really no excuse in not knowing how to make better efforts in working with tribal people and tribal communities and learning more about people who live in your area. And there's just there's no excuse, honestly. That's how I feel, because you just have to ask, you know?
Yeah.
I don't think you need to take a class. For sure. I don't think you need to go to college to learn more about tribal people and have a better understanding mm-hmm. of being Indian or wanting to get in touch with your roots or hey, say you had a best friend who was Indian growing up and you just wanted to understand them better, and you don't need to take a class. And I feel like it's not the job of institutions to do that. I feel like we're put in that position sometimes, mm-hmm. but it loses something in academics. So just go out, talk to Indians, man. They like to visit.
Yes. Well, and I mean, like you're saying, there's a lot of podcasts out there that are, you know, by Indigenous people on, you know, everything from everyday topics to things more like this. So there's at least one top 10 list that Indian Country put out today that maybe I can throw in the show notes if people are looking to find a podcast that deals with more of like the everyday issues and not necessarily just, you know, the nerd vacuum.
I guess that's my point, though, is I want our nerd vacuum to include people who are not, that you wouldn't think should, you know what I mean?
Okay.
Because if we...
So both ways, though.
Yeah,
then.
Yeah. This is a two-way street. Mm-hmm. And I feel like
right.
us as scholars, archaeologists, researchers, historians, we tend to only live within our concepts of what we're doing, right?
Mm-hmm.
We don't venture out because it's scary to venture out. You know, the reality is I find it fun. To me, that's like the modern exploration, is like taking what we have in this weird little group of knowledge that we have in this knowledge base and going, like, I love talking to my grandma about what I do, because she's definitely a preservationist, but she doesn't see, she's just an old crow lady, right? That's how she sees herself. She's a retired educator, but I love talking to her about what I do. And what I'm finding is that we have more in common with my discipline and her life than we do have differences. And I feel like our discipline in archaeology and heritage management, we don't do that enough. We don't just include the public to include it. We do it by mandate, you know, mm-hmm. and that's not good enough. We're not going to get nowhere doing that stuff. So.
Yes. okay, so we are already at our first break point.
Oh, wow.
And I know, right? It flies by. But one more thing that I want to throw in there while we were talking about the two-way street is to the Mashantucket Pequots, who I had on, I'd have to look up which episode that was, Michael from that podcast. He co-hosts the Native Opinion podcast. So he's a TIPO. He's a Tribal Historic Preservation Office. But they also, on that podcast, talk about a lot of the more everyday stuff, I think. So I believe that might be on the list that I'll attach in the show notes of the Indian Country Today's 10 podcasts. But check that out. If it's not in there, I can include the link to that show in the show notes as well. All right, and we will be right back.
This network is listener supported. We're trying to move away from paid advertising while also creating new shows and supporting the ones we have. The APN has never and will never make a serious profit on our podcast. Every little dime we make goes back into the network and improving show quality. So become a member today at www.arcpodnet.com/members to show your support, get some extras, and be a benefactor for archaeological education. Members get stickers, a coffee mug, a t-shirt, bonus content, early access to episodes, a private Slack team to talk to other members and the hosts, and full access to training on Team Black over at arccert.black. So check out our memberships at www.arcpodnet.com/members today and support archaeological education. That's www.arcpodnet.com/members. Now back to the show.
All right. And we are back. Okay. So before we keep going with all of this, I do want to go back a little bit and talk about, okay, you came out of your college and university experiences, and then what was the next steps in your journey after that?
I was unemployed.
Yep.
I was unemployed for a short time, and I actually did a year and a half as a paraprofessional in a middle school.
Mm-hmm.
And actually that job had a profound effect on the way I view my job now. And that's because working with seventh and eighth graders on an Indian reservation, you see the huge disconnect between identity, you know, like there's this big gap, in fact, a dangerously large gap in understanding who they are versus who they want to be and all that. And that alarmed me like a lot. And because I didn't realize growing up on the res, even though there was all this other stuff, this kind of colonized mentality happening, but on the backside of it, we were still very much Crow Indians, you know, and growing up going and participating in different things and the Crow kinship structure and social structure was still very much intact when I was young. So I still had a connection to my identity and knowing I was a Crow Indian and knowing that being a Psalo guy means to be this, right?
Mm-hmm.
but I growing up, I was comparing myself to my elders, which to me were like the Crowiest Crow Indians of all the Crows, right? So in comparison, I was not Crow. You know, in my mind, I'm like, well, if they're Crow, then what am I? And living here and seeing the disconnect with tribal youth and that identity, it scared me because it's not a good feeling. It can't be a good feeling of not knowing who you are, where you come from, how you got there, and what it means to be that. And I actually truly believe it contributes to the high rates of suicide in Indian country.
Right.
It's this lack of understanding where we come from, that we come from some of the most innovative people on the planet, that we come from genetically very strong people, resourceful people, and that we're all descendants of winners, you know? And it's
of the survivors.
Yeah, for sure. And when you look at the mortality rates of with Cortez and then the expansion west and the fact that we're still here is remarkable. Yeah. And that to be a part of that group, I take a lot of pride in that. Unfortunately, I just don't see young people. They don't have that understanding. And I feel like it would make them see the world different, you know, and see challenges different and see hardship different. Because it's like, if you understand what our ancestors had gone through, man, there's no reason why a bad breakup is just, that's all it is. It's a bad breakup. It's not something that should affect you in that way where you consider harming yourself or are getting involved in drugs and things like that. Like, we come from great people. You know, great people, and we're still great people, but we're kind of in recovery mode, you know, in Indian country. We're just kind of like in this, like, where societal post-traumatic stress, you know?
Yeah. I mean, they say that basically it's, the estimates are up to 90% of Indigenous people were wiped out in the years after Columbus. 90%. That's literally like, you think of 10 people, you know, 9 of them are dead.
Yeah.
How can you not still be in recovery? And I think that just really highlights what you're saying there is that, you know, that to survive that is huge. I mean, that just speaks really to the resilience of, you know, Native American people.
Yeah, for sure. And I think that if more people understood that, because the mortality rates are up to 90% in the East, that's solely from disease.
Yeah.
That has nothing to do with like societal pressure from the fur trade's impact, anything like that. And then in the West, I think it's anywhere up to 75% in the West. And you just think about it. The numbers are staggering. And then we've never addressed it really.
Right.
In Indian country, you know, because we were steamrolled, because it goes from the disease epidemics, and then it goes right into the expansion west, and then colonization with the church and the government. Then obviously, like, right after the Revolutionary War, there's this weird thing that happens where Indians help the British. So now the U.S. doesn't like Indians because they helped the British. So it turns into this thing. And it just gets worse and worse and worse. And then society, like the non-governmental population of the U.S. definitely contributed to a lot of it in terms of how the treatment of Indians. So when we teach history and we teach Indian history, we always teach it from a political standpoint and a military standpoint. We never, very rarely do we talk about society. What was the public doing? And the public was just as guilty. You know, and we don't ever want to address it. In fact, when we start talking about it, it makes people uncomfortable and they want to switch subjects and we're never going to recover from our issues in Indian country until we talk about the atrocities that happened, the real atrocities. I'm not talking about mascots and things like that. Those are problems, but as far as our list of problems, they're not in the top five for me. You know, and they are issues, but there's some major stuff that's happened and it continues to happen. And it all contributes to the work that I do you know, and that we do. This podcast is a result of it, right? Mm-hmm. Our program at SKC is a product of that mentality of something's got to change. We got to do something different, you know. And we recognize that identity is a major part of being who we are, and the lack of identity contributes to our problems. So how do we fix that? Well, we gotta mend the gap somehow. So it should be a concentrated effort to fix that gap, but it's hard to get people on board sometimes, you know?
Right. Why is that?
Because it's counter to everything, I think, in Indian country we've been taught. The last 150 years has been this, go to school, get the wife and the 2.5 kids, and the golden retriever and the picketed fence, mow your yard, go play golf. And it's like, I love mowing my yard. I love it. And every time I do it, I'm like, I'm super assimilated, you know? I love it. I just love mowing my yard. It's like, I love it. But to me, it's like the microcosm of like being assimilated. But anyway, so what I do now is I've tried to take that tool just as you have and other people have. I'm not the only one, but we try to take what we were told to do and make it work to fit who we are, you know? And I feel like that's what Indigenous archaeology is. It's much more than just archaeology done by Indians or for Indians. It's really for perpetuation and the protection and the preservation of identity. And it's much more than just simply recording sites and making recommendations, and that our efforts in Indigenous archaeology is part of a greater movement, right? And that, and I've said that before, that this movement is the restoration of identity and the protection of heritage, you know, and that we're just a part of it. We're not above it, below it, we're a part of it. And that's why when I was saying how we should be involved with Indian law scholars and Indian journalists, we should be part of that group. It seems as we've separated ourselves, mm-hmm. and I feel like, and I have nothing to back this up, but just feeling, is that it's because we want acceptance by archaeologists, that Indigenous archaeology wants to be accepted as a true subfield of archaeology, which I don't think we need to do that. I think what we're doing is part of a much bigger thing, and we need to jump on that ship and be with them, you know. Whether you're Indian or non-Indian, I think you can be an Indigenous archaeologist and be non-Indian. It's what's your intent and what's the goal? And if the goal is to help people, then go for it, man. That's what I'm about. Kind of went on a little rant there, sorry.
I love it. Yeah, no, that was fantastic. So, okay, can you give some examples then of some of the work that you've done that is Indigenous archaeology?
Oh, no, this is all theoretical.
All theoretical.
Well, I guess just every day, right? Teaching.
Right.
Like just teaching and raising kids is a huge part of what I do and why and I apply my knowledge to raising my kids, but on a more like discipline kind of based thing. Every archaeology job I've done, I've always made the voice I don't want to sound too righteous, but I've tried to make the voice of Indian people at the forefront, that it kind of be the driving force behind the entire project. That I think sometimes archaeologists, we can see ourselves as kind of we can get kind of righteous sometimes in how we do our job. We kind of become the authority, right, on certain subjects. When I feel like Indigenous archaeology is the opposite. All we are is collectors of information, and we transport that information to other places. And we can be the bridge between people. We take information and how do we apply it to everything else, right? We're kind of facilitators of Indigenous knowledge and understanding of landscape, as opposed to the authority on it, you know?
Right, right.
So I feel like every job I've done, when it's just regular a survey, working with consultation, even creating lesson plans, I always try to keep that in mind. I try. I fail at it a lot, you know. I really do, because I'm a human, you know. I try. I mean, it's hard sometimes, though, because we're running out of old people, you know. We're running out of those people who have that knowledge and really have that deep indigenous knowledge, that the good stuff, you know, the gold. They're there. They're still out there, but we are running out of them. So. But you did mention the National Geographic project. I guess that kind of was something.
Yeah, I would love to talk about that.
Yeah, yeah. You like that segue? Kind of segue, yes, right into that.
I do.
How this actually started was really out of a friend. I have a buddy named Jonathan Kingston, who's a photographer and has done quite a bit of work with Nat Geo. In fact, he's in, I think, Central America looking for Cortez's boats or something right now.
Huh?
So when Jonathan listens to this, I totally give him a shout. And he's not Indian, but when he was about 18, 19 years old, I probably got the age wrong, but he went to Crow and just wanted to be out there. And I'm sure that's his story, you know, but we met then. I was young. I was a pretty young guy in the 90s. I was like 12 or something. He was buddies with some of my relatives and my brother. And so I got to know him. Later on in life, he came back to Crow for a Crow Fair. Have you ever heard of Crow Fair?
Yeah.
Yeah, so he came for Crow Fair, huge gathering, all the crows get together. So he came for Crow Fair, came to my camp, we visited, kind of reconnected, and we were talking about what I do, you know, and he's like, man, Nat Geo really likes anthropologists, we should try to do something together. So we wrote a couple proposals on different things, and they failed. And then an opportunity came up to do a photo camp, and a Nat Geo photo camp is where a group of photographers and editors go to different places and teach that community's youth how to tell stories through photography. And that's like editing and the process, all the tactile aspects to photography. Well, when we proposed more like, what does it mean to be a Crow Indian? And let's use photography to do that. So what does being a Psalogan mean, you know, and tell that story through photography? So we wrote this proposal, they funded it, and we did it. So it's a week-long project. So Nat Geo sent out some photographers and editors and some amazing people that I still communicate with regularly. But my job in there was kind of to be like, to help the youth understand what it means to be Crow, to help the editors and the non-Indian people understand how to work in Crow society, you know, that the clock is kind of this foreign thing, you know, and it was a lot of fun because for me, it really got, I felt like I contributed to young Indian people, especially to young Crow youth, you know, like I was really into that part of it and I want to do it again. And it was a fun project. So we got to visit some archaeology sites. We got to do several things. I mean, it was them, right? They had to tell their story. What does it mean to be Crow Indian? And take photos of what that means to you. And so throughout the week, my job was just to kind of be there and for the Crow youth to say, hey, what is this? What does this mean when my grandparents say this to me? Or when we have to get ready for this doing and they make me do this, why do we do that? You know, that was a lot of the questions. Like it was simple things like that. By the end of the week, there was a transformation I saw in a lot of the students. In fact, one of the students is studying journalism now at the university. One of the students from the photo camp is in our tribal preservation program. So
that's awesome.
Yeah. So for me, that was a super rewarding experience. I got to kind of make connections, obviously. But for me, it was like, man, the Crow youth, that was awesome. I had a lot of fun with it.
So what would you want to do next time?
I would love to
the same thing again, or
yeah, mm-hmm. I would love to do it again, almost the same idea, because that was 10 kids or whatever out mm-hmm. of all the Crow youth. I'd like to do it in a different community on the reservation, for sure. But I would love to do it again. We just got to find the funding for it, because Jonathan's down to do it again. So
yeah,
it'll That's happen.
Amazing. Yeah. Yeah. All right. Well, we are actually already at our second break point. It goes so fast. But yeah, yeah, I love that. And it reminds me a lot of this Ute STEM camp thing that we just did this past week. And the kids, again, this past month or two, not week. They really loved that, the photography and videography aspect as well. So I'm having a lot of images of them playing around with the cameras when you're talking about this. But
that's cool.
In addition to listening to their elders, it was very, very cool thing to be a part of.
Now that visual anthropology is like kind of taken off.
Seems
to make sense to do that kind of stuff. So it's pretty cool.
Yeah. Yeah. So on that warm and fuzzy note, we are going to take our second break.
The Archaeology Podcast Network has partnered with Tee Public to bring you some awesome gear that looks good, promotes archaeology, and puts a few pennies in our pockets so you can get free podcasts. Check out our designs at arcpodnet.com/shop. That's arcpodnet.com/shop.
All right. And we are back. And man, all of you listening just missed a really great off-air discussion. So we decided to hit record because you guys are missing some great stuff, talking about tribes and their resilience after being moved from their homeland and taking the stories from their original homelands and placing them on the landscape of where they are now. Really, just really interesting stuff.
It's the best stuff.
Yeah, the best stuff.
The best conversation was we weren't recording.
I know.
I apologize to the listeners.
No, it's great.
We'll save it for a different podcast.
Yes, we'll just have to do this again. Cool. Okay, so there's a couple things that I want to touch on. So first, it sounds like your background, from my understanding, is both in cultural anthropology and archaeology. Could you talk a little bit about your experience? I don't know, I guess like blending the two.
Yeah, actually this topic got brought up at my thesis defense.
Oh yeah.
I didn't know I was doing anything different. I thought this is what all archaeologists did. That's how naive I was. I thought all archaeologists talk to Indians. And so how I fell in love with the discipline was through cultural anthropology, was the mm-hmm. discipline of ethnography and understanding oral history, right? And how does that fit into archaeology? I have my master's is in general anthropology. I don't have a focus. Mm-hmm. It was more of a financial decision, right, to do that as opposed to going down like cultural heritage emphasis or something. Anyone who knows anthropology knows if you want to make money, you got to do archaeology, right? So,
unfortunately, as an ethnographer, yes, I learned that one.
I was the same way, right? Because my true love is ethnography, field ethnography. Mm-hmm. And actually what I've really learned to love is re-examining old ethnographies like Robert Lowy and Edward Curtis and Frank Linderman and Claude Schaefer and Franz Boas and these guys, like going back, looking at their works. And actually, they get a bad rap, you know? And so I kind of like go through them and try to find the value in a lot of those works that they did. And so the overall field of ethnography has kind of become a passion, more of a passion project as opposed to like a viable employment, right? Because archaeology is that way. So really how it started, where I blended the two together, was in 2011, I worked for the Bureau of Land Management, Montana, Dakota's office with the state tribal liaison. His name was Mark Sant. Great guy. I worked for him. He was, his focus was really more about like cultural resource law and compliance. So is federal agencies doing their due diligence, right? Are they really putting forth a good faith, right?
Right.
So it was not an archaeology job. But one day, an archaeologist comes in and says, we're going to do some prescribed burns in the Pryor Mountains. Are you willing to take you and your guy up there and look at these small parcels of ground? He's like, yeah, it'd be good for Aaron. You know, it's like, I was fresh, right? Didn't know nothing. So let's go up there. And I think they just thought of it more as a good learning opportunity for me. Mm-hmm. So we go up there and immediately... We're at a place, East Pryor Mountain, the Dryhead Vista. And immediately we're like, this is a special place. There's fasting beds everywhere. And we quickly forget about the reason we were there. We start trying to solve the crime. Why is there so many fasting beds here? So that night I go home back to Crow and talk to people. And quickly that question's answered. This is why, because I'm asking, like, hey, why is that? And right there, that's the moment, that actual moment of casual conversation is when I for the very first time applied oral history to archaeology. That was that little moment. And it was like a drug to me. I got a euphoric feeling from it, from not even solving the crime necessarily, but it was more like putting pieces in a puzzle together. It felt really good to do that, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So, and then I just kept applying that method to everything I would do. So whenever we'd come across a new site, I'd do my field notes and we'd do all the stuff archaeologists do, right? Especially federal archaeologists. We do our thing. And then I'd go home and I'd be like, hey, I ran across this site. And they would say that eventually that conversation it gets a little more formalized and notes start to be taken. And then it eventually gets recorded. And then I transcribe the recordings. And then I add that knowledge into the field notes, into the site documentation. And eventually it just becomes the way I do things, right? I wrote my entire thesis on the fasting beds that we found in the Pryors and the archaeology of fasting and why Crow people fast and all that. And I unknowingly just started placing these interviews into the documentation and into the interpretation of the site. And I never thought about it, you know, I just never thought about it. And one of my committee members asked me a very similar question that you just asked. What made you want to apply ethnography to the archaeology? And I didn't even know how to answer the question because it wasn't a conscious decision.
Right.
One of my other committee members actually answered it for me. Jeff Benjamin, and he said he was worked with a lot of tribal people, and he said that's just what Indian people do, basically. You know, there's never been this disconnection between the narrative and the land and the things on the land. And I unknowingly just kind of took that method and applied it to the job of archaeology, and I didn't really notice until years later when I would try to do that with other projects. They'd be like, well, there's nothing in here about supplemental information. We don't need to do that. And I'm like, what? Like my brain, I just was not into that. It's so boring. I was like, I want to tell the story. And so I feel like that's a paramount aspect to Indigenous archaeology is the narrative. You tell a narrative, right? And so it was such a foreign idea to me to do that, to not tell the story. So in my mind, I was like, so you just want me to record objects? you know, like, and I was like, all right, I'll do it. I'm not going to like it though, you know? So, to answer your question, I didn't know that I was doing that. And I just did it from the beginning. Since I'm now aware of it, I've tried to refine it. I've tried to create my own style of it, because I feel like every tribal community is a little different in how they like to share information and how they like that information disseminated. And so I think part of being a tribal ethnographer is understanding that dilemma and how do you mitigate that. As opposed to years in the past, you would just go out with your little Indiana Jones hat and your you would hire a Indian guy to carry all your stuff for you, and you set up your wall tent and you bring in informants, you know. Mm-hmm. We don't do that, you know. And what I do is I just visit people and I'm very straightforward about what I'm doing and why I'm doing it. So right away we address the elephant in the room, and I say, this is what I am, but first and foremost, I'm an Indian person. And I'm a Crow Indian before I'm an ethnographer, before I'm an archaeologist. So, and I feel like that really sets the pace for them. When you have a base knowledge of culture, of understanding of culture already, and like living in it, you can skip pleasantries, right? Because when a non-Indian ethnographer comes in and talks to like the Crows or the Blackfeet or the Salish, there's always this triage type moment, right? Where you gotta like, how much do they know? So you go through this like Salish understanding 101, Crow understanding 101, right? And by the time that's done, the project's over.
Right.
Because every tribal person's going to do that. We're going to go through this narrative, right? We're going to go through this whole thing, because it's this idea of holistic knowledge, right? We're going to go through, what do you know? And I find that a lot of ethnographers today don't have that patience to sit there and listen to that. In my experience, we don't have to go through that. So when I sit down and talk to old people or to knowledgeable historians and Crow concepts, I can just say, tell me about this, and I'll say it. And so just by the way I ask the question tells them that I already know the foundation of that question. So they don't need to spend an hour and a half talking to me about that.
Right.
You know.
Right.
So, for example, I was visiting an old lady who had since passed away named Winona Plenty Hoops, who amazing person. She's what's called a mixer. A mixer is a role you play in the Crow Tobacco Society. So I was doing a project where I was trying to find tobacco gardens, like where were Crows planting this tobacco garden. So a traditional ethnographer would come in and say, Winona, my name's so-and-so, blah, 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 blah. We're doing this project on this. Tell me about the Tobacco Society. So Winona would have to go through the step-by-step process of telling the ethnographer about the Tobacco Society and how that works before we could get to the tobacco gardens. And that makes sense, right?
Right.
Totally makes sense. But with me, I could walk in to Winona's, at the time she was in the nursing home, and I told her to tell me about Obowasua. Obowasua is the ceremony of planting tobacco. And immediately she starts talking about that ceremony. We didn't have to go through the migration of the Crows through the Northern Plains into the Rocky Mountain region and the search for the tobacco plant and the adoption of Chief No Vitals and his son and how that works and all that stuff. And, you know, immediately by me wording the question that way, she already in her mind's like, this guy knows that, you know, we're going to go right into it. So I feel like I'm at a huge advantage, especially when I work with Crow people, because we don't have to go through that, mm-hmm. you know, and that, because of funding and things like that, people don't have the time to do that, you know, because if I was a non-Indian ethnographer working for some publication, and I walked in there and said, Winona, tell us about the tobacco planting ceremony. She's not going to start at the tobacco planting ceremony. She's going to start at the migration of the crows.
Right.
But because I worded it a certain way, you know, she just went with it. And I've since applied that. I've taken that template and I've applied it to other tribes, to the Salish, to the Blackfeet. Granted, it takes a lot of off time studying, like on your own time. You have to create that foundation, because just because I'm asking that question, people could get it wrong. That just learn the right questions. That's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is, on your off time, you have to do your work. You have to do your research. And there's a lot of times where I've sat and stared at my computer, or stared in a book, or reread notes, or taken transcriptions from old interviews, and painstakingly went through them, and tried to take, when somebody says a word in Blackfeet language or in the Crow language, or and they translate it into English, I have to go backwards. So if they say something is a certain thing in that language, what they could lose translation. So I'm learning all of that over again. So do you get what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Yeah. So you got to go through all this stuff before you can ask that question, before I can come into the Blackfoot society. I'd say, tell me about the Motokiks, right? Like this woman society. Tell me about them. I got to know my base before I ask that. And that process is delicate too, though. And that process might take years. For me, I had to sing a lot of years and sit at a drum with a drum group from Standoff, Alberta, that I had to, my wife is Blackfeet, that I've spent time in that community amongst other Blackfoot speaking peoples. And so that doesn't necessarily mean our job is just based on questions. Our job is really based on that foundation. Your validity as an ethnographer is based on the effort you put into ethnography before the fieldwork's ever done.
Right.
And it's paid off immensely for me, because my entire livelihood is based on talking to Indian people, which, man, that's the best thing ever.
It is. It is.
So I'm sorry. I kind of went on a tangent there, but I didn't know I was doing anything different, but now that I know, I'm aware of it and I try to get better at it every day. So.
Right. And okay. So one thing I want to say before we get away from this topic is that people should be doing that. So if we're talking about the BLM, for example, and we're talking about compliance, if they're doing compliance, they should be considering traditional cultural properties. So if they're just looking at the archaeology and not looking at the feasting beds as a potential traditional cultural property, they're not fulfilling their Section 106 requirements. So I do just want to say that, like, people treat it like it's this like extra or supplemental, but that is part of the law. So if you are not considering traditional cultural properties, you're not doing your job. So just throwing that in there real quick.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
Did you say feasting or fasting?
Sorry, fasting, right? Wasn't it?
Yeah, fasting.
Or was it fasting? Yeah. And that's what you talked about in your TEDx talk, right?
Yeah, that was one person in particular. Like I'm a descendant of a guy named Goes Ahead, and I talked about his thing, like his experience and kind of, and that the whole TEDx talk is that was an interesting thing, because I didn't even know what TED was. And a lady asked me to do this talk. She said, we're going to do this talk. And I thought she said for TED, like a guy, like I'm going to talk for it. And so I was like, yeah. So I kept getting these emails and I didn't know. So when you watch that video, it's completely a one shot freestyle. I didn't rehearse it as you're supposed to intend. So if anyone's listening out there, I would love another opportunity to redeem myself on the TED thing. And I promise you won't be disappointed.
We're putting that out into the universe. Yes. Yeah. So. Okay. Cool. Yeah, definitely listen. It's well worth listening. And is it okay if we include that in the show notes?
Yeah, you can.
Okay, we don't have to.
No, you can, as long as you keep in my excuse for why it is the way. I tend to do that, though. I didn't do my research as I complain about other people not doing it. I didn't know what TED was. I had no idea that it was this huge thing and that people rehearse and I have to stand on a red dot. And yeah, it was pretty interesting. But I was going to read this to you. I've recently started this Indigenous Archaeology Instagram page, and it's just for me to like rant and rave on, you know. But I wrote this little quote on there, and it kind of fits with what we're talking about with ethnography and the work we do. So the quote is, the application of oral histories to archaeology is at the forefront of the research. At no point is the narrative of tribal people secondary. This methodology is the foundation of our work. No longer should Indian people be delegated to the appendices, and no longer are we supplemental human.
Yes. Yes, love that. And what's your Instagram handle so anyone on Instagram can follow you?
Oh, it's just Indigenous Archaeology. That's all. It's perfect. just Indigenous Archaeology.
Awesome. Okay.
Yeah. Follow me. Is that weird to say? That's weird to,
no,
me to say.
No, not that. Weird to say. People will learn a lot if they follow you.
Okay. All right. So yeah, let's move on. We can move on or whatever you got.
Well, to close out, let's talk real quick about some more about the program. So the Tribal Historic Preservation Program. And can you just give me kind of a background on what you're doing and what you want your students to come away with? I mean, we were talking on the break again that this is basically, as far as we know, and I think I heard that there's one other maybe or one coming, but definitely one of the only tribal historic preservation programs in the country. So definitely I think our listeners would be interested in learning more about the program and what students will get out of it.
So Salish Kootenai College, just to let everybody know, is in Pablo, Montana, on the Flathead Indian Reservation. So beautiful campus. I mean, I'm trying to sell the product here. So our program, we have an associate's and a bachelor's degree in tribal historic preservation. We also have a tribal governance program and administration, which is fairly new, but it's kicking off. There's three faculty that teach out of that, and they're all amazing people. And there's major benefits to be a part of that program as well. I'm trying to get people to double major. That's my thing. But our program focuses on all things anthropology, of course, except for forensics. We don't do anything with forensics or physical anthropology. Of course, all Indigenous approaches to everything. And
was that a
like a conscious decision?
Yeah, that's the word, conscious decision.
I think it was. The founder of the program is Jeff Benjamin, who now teaches sociology at the College of New Rochelle in New York. He was out west here for a while, and he's kind of a mentor to me. Like I really look up to him a lot. He's a great guy, and he was on my committee and stuff. He's a good dude, super good at his job, and he created the program. So I never went through the program. It was just regular NAS when I was there. So maybe you should have him on sometime and he can explain more about it. As far as I know, though, I think it was a conscious decision. And but we also focus on cultural resource law and practice. Our students have to take an intro to tribal preservation, which is kind of the overview of the laws. But when I teach it, we also talk about tribal government. What's tribal government's role? So every week is a theme. So each week is like museum studies, anthropology, tribal government. And we just kind of go down the line. Dean Nikolai, the other faculty, teaches a little bit different, but mine's more of an overview of all things tribal preservation. So that's heritage education and all things like that. So then, but we do go over the laws in there. And then we have a 300 level CRM class. And then they're required to take a NEPA course.
Awesome.
Yeah, so they take a NEPA course and then three sections of GIS.
Man. Yeah. I want to go to this program.
Yeah, and they're required to do two field experiences before they can graduate. So one is typically it's a field school, but if we don't have a field school opportunity, you can do it somewhere else. But internships, to do a tribal internship, government internship. We have a museum studies. We do a museum studies, federal Indian law and policy, cultural resource law and management, GIS. Geology, sociology. Plus we have the whole like indigenous or traditional tool making classes you have to take and things like that. So it's heavy. It's heavy. I actually counted the credits a while back for some other thing I did where we actually have more relevant anthropology courses than an anthropology program. and we're always working to make it better and develop. I want to develop a field ethnography class. I'm kind of working on that.
That's awesome.
Because right now we just kind of incorporate it into advanced archaeological field methods. When I teach that class, I do teach us a week or two on ethnography and how that works in archaeology. So.
No, we totally deserve our own class.
Yeah, for sure. Because honestly, I know archaeology pays the bills, but ethnography is what keeps you wanting to do it. That's how I feel. Like it just makes me want to keep doing the job. Plus, an indigenous approach to archaeology, it encompasses all aspects of heritage knowledge, right? Like we don't just say, well, I'm an archaeologist. Whatever, that's you guys do that. That seems to be kind of common in anthropology where, oh, he's the rock art guy, so I'm not gonna.
Right, that, right.
We're in Indian country, we don't have rock art guy, we don't have lifted guy. Like it all contributes to the thing. So the goal is on the left side, and we're not worried about rock art guy. We're all rock art guy, you know,
right.
So that's why I always say indigenous archaeology, but to me indigenous archaeology encompasses ethnography, all forms of anthropology, heritage education, museum studies, cultural resource law, federal Indian law. So because it's indigenous archaeology would be that true holistic approach, as Franz Boas said, even though he didn't do. Is that too soon? Was that too soon to
no, not too soon.
To go after the Godfather.
Love it.
Yeah. So.
And you have students from across the country, it sounds like. And just a quick shout out to your students. Thank you for sending your professor my way.
Yeah. We have students from Minnesota. Emma actually is the one who was really pushing me to do this. So shout out
hi,
to
Emma.
Yeah, say hi to Emma. She's gonna love it.
Love it.
Yeah, she's non-Indian, but she has a deep passion for this work and working in Indian country, mainly in the heritage education part of things, side of the thing, but definitely wants to contribute, you know. And she's a reflection of other students we have. We have students from other reservations, Rocky Boy and Canada. We have a student from Hobima, Alberta. We have students from, all over. It seems like Emma came from, she actually holds a BA in anthropology, but from my understanding, that really didn't give her what I think she was looking for. So she's in our program now, and I think she seems to like it. So
awesome.
So, but we have a lot of great students, and I find that this program attracts a certain type of student. And these are students that are like, they want to contribute, you know, they want to contribute to their communities, to their environment, to their families. Like it's not about getting a job, I find.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not trying to disrespect any other discipline, but you do see that in other disciplines where it's like, well, which job really coming out of the gate, what could I work? Where could I work? And which is a right. legitimate reason for education for sure. But what I find in our program is we have students that's kind of secondary. They're looking for something bigger, you know, and I really think that's awesome. Oh, and my nephew's in the program too. So that's kind of rewarding. So
yeah, that's awesome.
Yeah.
Well, we need more of them in this world. So
yes, for sure.
Yes. So glad that they're there.
And our degree is versatile. So like, you don't have to do archaeology with our degree. Like I know for a fact, you could work in tribal government. You could work as a tribal liaison, a consultant. Mm-hmm. It's not limited to archaeology.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so I think that's why a lot of people like our job. Really, our job is to create typos. You know, that's that was kind of the mission statement of the program. But we find that a lot of students, they still want to be federal archaeologists. They still want to be their tribe's archaeologists or run the curation center for a tribe or things like that. So our degree can fit a lot of things. So,
yeah, that's
come
amazing.
To SKC.
Everybody. I know. Like, I want to come visit.
Yeah. Yeah.
Cool.
You should come out and do a podcast on our campus.
I should do that. One of these days I'm gonna make this a traveling podcast.
Yes, come out, do the podcast.
Yes. So. Yes, cool. Okay, well, we are way over as always.
All right.
So it's time. Yeah, hopefully maybe we can do this again sometime. And thank you. Thank you again for coming on and sharing your knowledge.
Yeah, for sure. I wouldn't be where I'm at if it wasn't for my folks and my wife and my community. So I owe it all to those fellers.
Well, thank you to them too.
Yep. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening to the Heritage Voices podcast. You can find show notes at www.archaeologypodcastnetwork.com/heritagevoices. Please subscribe to the show on iTunes, Stitcher, or the Google Music Store. Also, if you like the show, please share with your friends or write us a review. If you have any questions, comments, or show suggestions, please reach out to me at jessica@livingheritageanthropology.org, or you can find me on Facebook through Living Heritage Anthropology or on Twitter @LivingHeritageA. As always, thank you to Lyle Blanqua and Jason Nez for their collaboration on our incredible logo.
This show is produced by the Archaeology Podcast Network, Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle in Reno, Nevada at the Reno Collective.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.